The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Kevin Fong. I'm sitting in for Alok Jar while he's off on his Antarctic adventures. Explore this week on the show...
Go ahead, Houston.
Mission abort. Repeat. Mission abort.
It's fair to say that until the sad passing of the great Nelson Mandela, most dinner parties were alive with conversation about this film. The film Gravity, of course. We dust off our award-winning Sounds of the Space Shuttle, an astronaut's account of a journey in the now-retired space shuttle, and bring it to you again. Also on the show, I'll be joined by The Guardian and the Observer's science team to discuss this week's big news stories, including the discovery of the oldest known human DNA in Spain and what it says about human evolution, the first face transplant patients discuss life after their life-changing surgery, and neuroscience tinkers with the brain's will to persevere. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. I'm joined by the combined Guardian and Observer science team. Nicola Davis is Observer writer and Observer Tech Monthly commissioning editor. Welcome back, Nicola.
Hello, good morning.
Ian Sample is the Guardian science correspondent. And last but by no means least, Robin McKee is the Observer science editor and winner of this year's Press Gazette Best Science Writer Award. Congratulations, Robin.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
It's full of award wins, this show. Well, Robin, we're kicking off with you and your choice of story. Why a thigh bone discovered in a Spanish cave has raised interesting questions about human evolution. Tell us about that.
This is the work of a team led by Svante Paabo at Leipzig. His team have found DNA that's 400,000 years old in the thigh bone found in the Simula de Huesos. I've got to say that means cave of the pit of the bones. And usually I end up saying pit of the eggs and similar huesos, but it's not that. It's a pit of the bones, place in near Burgos in Spain, where they found 28 bodies, skeletons of 400,000 year old human beings, probably early Neanderthals. That's 400,000 years ago. Shouldn't be able to get DNA out of it. Far too old, fragmented long before then, but somehow they've managed to get a sequence of mitochondrial DNA out of one of these bones. An astonishing achievement in itself. And then when they sequence it, they find out that it appears to be, the people there appear to be related to another set of early humans, this time found in Siberia. These are the Denisovans. So what on earth was going on? What kind of human struggles were being involved at that time? We do not know. The intriguing thing about it is it just shows how complex the situation was with different forms of humanity at that time, both in Europe and in Africa. It's just made the kind of picture of early human evolution that bit more complex and a great deal more interesting.
So where does this leave us then? What is the landscape look like with regard to the evolutionary struggles of the past?
Well, I mean, what you're seeing is these are, there's a species of early human called Homo heidelbergensis, and it's, say, about 500,000 years ago, and it has evolved from the ancestors of Homo erectus, which originally evolved in Africa. They've ended up in Europe. Homo heidelbergensis is then appears to be evolving into several different forms of humanity. Neanderthals, Denisovans, probably somebody else as well. And they eventually, Neanderthals take over, and about 40, 50,000 years ago, Homo sapiens appears in Europe, having evolved in Africa maybe 150,000 years ago. And we just take over the world, and all these different forms of humanity are wiped out. As Nicola said earlier on, we were the grey squirrels of the human race. We did for every other squirrel, including these guys that were found down the cave in Las Amas. It's a very good analogy.
Climbing that evolutionary mountain to become a grey squirrel is a bit unedifying. So did we just outcompete these other groups, or were we better at surviving them? Did we club them to death? What happened?
Well, there are many different... Well, club them to death, probably not. We were just a bit better at getting resources. The Robin Dunbar, British paleontologist, has the idea that we were that bit smarter, that bit cleverer, and we were better at making alliances with other tribes of modern humans. So, in other words, we had our social network was better than the Neanderthals, and when times were hard, we could remember groups that we had helped, and we were able to sort of get together with each other and help each other. Neanderthals were just that bit less able to do it, and we just took the resources from them. That's really what happened. I don't think we clubbed them to death.
And you've been to this place, haven't you? This cave of, I want to say eggs now, it's not eggs.
Yeah, sorry, the pit of the eggs. It's an extraordinary place run by this guy, Arswega. It's in the bottom of a labyrinth that is maybe a couple of miles under the ground, and it really is extraordinary. I'm quite claustrophobic, and the only way you can get in is to go about a kilometre along this labyrinth, squeezing through rocks, and eventually you come to a pit that goes straight down in the ground, and there's a sort of dome of rock, dome over it, and it goes straight down, in, as I say, about 40 metres. There is a single wire ladder, drops down it, and you have to climb down that. I mean, it's into pitch black. And at the bottom of the pit, in this red clay, you can see the bones of early humans sticking out of the red rock. And it's, you know, in a business where if you find, you know, a tiny bit of a fragment of thumb or toenail or something like that, you think it's, wow, this is a great discovery. They've got 28 skeletons worth down there, and they're still digging them out. I mean, it's absolutely an astonishing place.
Leaving that behind, we're on now to Nicola, who's found a piece about a group who think that cave and all its contents couldn't have been more than 6,000 years old.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting piece. This was in The Observer yesterday. It's by Alice Roberts in the Discover section. And it's fascinating. It's about a zoo in Bristol. It's called the Noah's Ark Zoo Farm. And it's a farm which is basically... a creationist farm, so farm zoo even. So it's sort of promoting a slightly different idea, and it's you know, it's very much pitched at, you know, education and bringing your kids along and show them the wonders of the world. And it's a quite a different take, I would say, and quite a worrying one, for sure. So, you know, they have, Alice mentions that they have posters saying things like 30 reasons why apes are not related to man. I'm not sure what you think about that, Robin.
Not a lot, to be blunt.
And, you know, sort of this idea of a sort of young earth theory and all sorts. And it's, I think what bothered me most about this was the sort of influence it's going to have on kids. So,
is it that worrying? Shouldn't science be robust enough to stand up for one exhibit that puts across this idea, you know, if we're happy that we can falsify it with evidence?
Well,
should we feel that threatened?
I don't think it's a question of scientists feeling threatened. I think it's something which, you know, should concern sort of society and communities, that science isn't really being listened to here. This is all about, you know, trying to set up almost a false debate, I think. And that's quite concerning. People maybe don't have all the insider knowledge about science. They're trying to do their best for their kids. They see this kind of attraction. They think, why not? And that is worrying.
Kevin, I agree with your suggestion, actually, that maybe we can get overly worried about these things, and that science... I've always wondered a little bit about all the fuss over creationism, and my own view has been... Or certainly was at the beginning, that, well, science is far, far more robust and easily capable of dealing with this. But I think that's probably fairly easy to say from the UK, where you don't see what's happening in the US, where it's getting into school curricula. And there really are serious issues with creationism affecting education. I see things like this actually as being this creationist zoo in Bristol. Actually, I'm changing my mind and finding it deeply sinister, actually. And one thing that made me worry a little bit more about this was, I was at the Natural History Museum fairly recently, and I, where they've got an awful lot of fantastic dinosaur skeletons and stuff like, and I overheard a dad tell his son, I guess, that the dinosaurs died out because it was cold in the last ice age, 11,000 years ago. And And you think this is, you know, and this is a kid who is, I don't know how high, I mean, you know, hip height, who is getting an that's kind of an education, because his dad's telling him, rather than reading the plaques at the museum, and this is an excellent museum, a premier museum, and I think even at places like that where you have, you know, the amount of misinformation and dramatic misinformation that's around is actually starting to become a real worry. And I do find things like this are not going to help. I mean, we're allowed to swear. It's bullshit.
People can pass this off as saying, oh, well, you know, does it matter if people, you know, in the day-to-day lives, how many people is this really going to affect? Does it matter if people have, you know, slightly dodgy views about, you know, how things came into being? But I think that's a very naive and very simple way of putting it, because, you know, people go on and become policymakers. They go on and become teachers. They go on and to have influence in society. And that should be based upon good, sound education. And this is not a good, sound education.
Should we have given them the oxygen of publicity? Question.
Well, there's a good point there, because you make the Noah's Ark sounds fantastic.
So, conclusion is it's all Nicola's fault for bringing it up in the first place.
Brilliant.
Let's leave creationism behind, which is what most sensible people do, I think. Your story this week, your news story this week, relates to a surgical revolution, and one quite close to my own heart, the transplantation of faces. Tell us about that.
Well, I was just intrigued by this. I mean, this is the story about, you know, 2 years after his full face transplant. Dallas Wines, we're not quite sure how that's pronounced, we can go with Wines, you know, it spoke out about the impact that this has had on his life. And it was a really very moving news story, actually. And I think what I was most fascinated about here was sort of looking at the progress that has been made in transplantation and also in, you know, sort of surgery and in so many areas of science. So, for example, you know, it's only 100 years ago that Harold Gillies was doing his fantastic work with soldiers that were coming back from the First World War with horrific injuries. 1950s, you know, the first organ transplants. One of the reasons this story was so interesting was because the findings were talking about how it may be possible to carry out such an operation, and you only need to attach, it says here, 2 facial or neck arteries instead of several to allow this transplantation to work. And that is obviously a huge step forward.
And that's right. I mean, for the longest time, I think they thought face transplants would be impossible, because the anatomy of the face is one of those things that fills medical students with dread. You know, it's so complicated. All the nerves, all of the blood vessels. You have to have any number of obscene mnemonics to try and remember it all. And yet this discovery that a few principal connections could do the job really has changed everything. So what's happened now? And indeed, what are the latest events in the United States in this area?
Well, it seems that this is the big sort of breakthrough, is that you don't need to connect up every single blood vessel in it. You can actually get away with far fewer and still get the job done. I mean, obviously, this is still a really nascent area for medical research. You know, it's a handful of full face transplants that have been carried out. So it's sort of what they're learning is still sort of an exponential growth almost in what people are understanding about this. I mean, last year I spoke to a doctor who did the transplant on Richard Norris, who was another famous face transplant patient. And, you know, there they also transplanted a tongue and jaw and so on and so forth. And so the fact you can actually completely reconstruct a face, not just the tissue, but also, you know, transplant bone and such like, is an incredible achievement. And I think that the step that people are talking about is things like trying to get lips to behave like lips. It's very special tissue, and getting a tongue to not just look like a tongue, but behave like a tongue. And that sort of areas, I think, which we're going to see a lot more progress in.
And this is, as you say, is about more than just covering an area with new undamaged skin, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think the other thing is not just the medical side of this, but the sort of impact this has on people's lives, you know, the emotional impact. I think this comes across very strongly in you know, what Dallas Wines was saying. You know, he says, my entire life is a miracle. And, you know, he's talking a lot about just the sort of impact it has had on him to be able to go out and to kind of start to claim back his life. I think that is a huge and thing. I think it should be celebrated in science.
Do you know if they end up looking as they looked before, or do they look more like the person who is the sort of face donor? Because I remember speaking to one of the surgeons on the British team that was looking at this, and he said you would expect it to be somewhere in between. But that sort of assumes a particular type of transplant, and within face transplant sort of surgery, there are all different ways of doing these kinds of things, and all of those have an impact on the psychological aspects of what you see in the mirror when the swelling's gone down, right? So he's blind, but for his family and friends, does he look how he looked beforehand, or does he look more like this, you know, towards the donor?
So I mean, I interviewed Dallas, I think it's Dallas Veen's surgical team, and I've seen the photographs of him before he was injured and afterwards, and immediately after the operation, it's very difficult to tell because there's so much swelling, as you say. But with time, you begin to settle to the face that you're going to have, and it is very different, very different. And the thing is that you know, you have this sort of slightly science fiction understanding of face transplants, the idea that you might switch entirely identities, that whole, what was that, Nicolas Cage film, Face Off or whatever, where John Travolta miraculously becomes Nicolas Cage and vice versa. And of course, that can't happen because your underlying appearance is more than just the skin. It's the bone structure, which doesn't completely come across, although some of it does, and the size and the shape of the head. So you know, you don't really retain much similarity, I think, with the donor, is my understanding. Now, with a determination that is completely of our own, we move to Ian's choice of story. Ian, it seems researchers in Stanford have done something pretty extraordinary in neurological terms. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think this could be helpful for all of us, actually. It's an interesting case study, and it's probably the only case study I've read in a journal that references a 1603 bit of work by Shakespeare. But anyway, it's what these guys have done is they were doing some exploratory sort of procedures on a couple of chaps who had epilepsy, and so they were trying to find the focus of the what was causing the epilepsy. And while you're doing that, you're putting electrodes, dropping electrodes, fine electrodes deep into the brain, and you're passing electric currents through them. You're trying to kind of create the aura so you can find out where the sort of affected tissue is so you can remove it or deal with it in another way. And while they were doing that, they had an experiment running, which you're allowed to do, where they were just asking them what they felt at when they had the electrodes at various different positions around the brain as they were trying to sort of find out where this region was.
And Ian, these are electrodes that are penetrating into the substance of
That's
the brain.
Right. They go through the skull, they go into the brain tissue. Yeah, it's invasive. But what was interesting is they found an area in the anterior mid-cingulate cortex, a very small area here, where in the first patient, he started talking about when they stimulated this area, and we're talking about 2 to 8 milliamps, and they did it with shams. So, you know, they tested that it wasn't, that it only happened when the electrical stimulation was there by telling him they were stimulating when they weren't. But it gave him a sense of quite a complex reaction, actually. He had a very physical reaction where his chest started feeling like it was sort of shaking, his heartbeat went up a little bit, and he got this sense of sort of an enormous challenge, kind of a foreboding, but then an incredible, they call it a will to persevere, and you have to sort of call these things something, I suppose, a kind of real sense of determination to get through a looming challenge. Now, the first patient they did it, they thought, well, that was a bit unexpected, but they didn't report it. But then they were doing the same kind of procedure on a second patient, and at the same area, this guy responded in a very similar way, that a sense of kind of something bad was going to happen, but that he was going to get through it come what may. And I think what's really interesting about that is that you are inducing a pretty high-level conscious state by just running some electrons through a very small part of brain tissue. And these guys have very different backgrounds. They're not, you know, it's kind of experience independent, if you like, you know, that what you're achieving here. And if you do the stimulation 5 millimeters away, you don't get anything like that effect. And that is potentially really interesting because, okay, first of all, you have to ask the question, is this going to make people more determined to persevere at something, or is it just a sensation of something? And this is something that the group really wants to look at now, but also trying to do it in maybe a less invasive way. Like you can do these things with by sort of stimulating the brain from the outside using techniques like transcranial direct current stimulation and magnetic stimulation. So So where does this lead? Well, one thing you might be able to do is use this to improve the lot of people with severe depression who find themselves spectacularly unmotivated because of their depression. And if you can excite this area of the brain, maybe you may be able to give those people a bit more of their sort of functional lives back.
I had a look at that paper and I was quite struck by the language. I mean, it's pretty graphic, isn't it? I mean, do you have a quote there? They talk about this, you know. It's not just, I feel a little bit like I'm a bit more determined now. They sort of create this entire scenario, you know, it's the guy who was driving through the storm that I remember.
Yeah, well, this is what the paper says. It says, he reported that he felt as if he were driving a car into his storm. In his words, it said, like you're headed towards a storm that's on the other side, maybe a couple of miles away, and you've got to get across the hill, and all of a sudden you're sitting there going, how am I going to get over that? And then they said, look, say a bit more about this. Tell us how you're feeling about it. And he said, well, if you knew you were driving your car and it was one of the tires was half flat and you're only halfway there and you have no other way to turn around and go back, you have to keep going forwards. And they said, well, look, is this a negative experience? It sounds terrifying. Or is it a pretty positive thing? And he said, it was actually more positive. And he said, it was just push harder, push harder, push harder to try and get through this. And it was quite stark language that he was using.
That's incredible military implications, doesn't it? You can imagine your helmet being wired up and you're being sent into battle and then you press a little button and away you go, you know?
It really does have those tones, doesn't it? This is like an instant berserker switch, you know, flick and you're gone. Yeah. Does that worry you?
Yes, it does.
Another neurobiologist I was talking to about this was saying that, look, we already ablate areas of this brain in some cases to treat things like OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, where people are kind of almost over-motivated, if you like. And so the idea that you then say, well, instead of basically destroying part of it, you stimulate part of it for people where there's a problem, like in depression, then he said, what's wrong with that? Even if it involves this deep brain stimulation along the same lines as is done now for Parkinson's disease.
For this story and all the stories we've covered today, just go to the best science news site on the web, theguardian.com/science. Well, with gravity firmly on our minds, we thought it was a perfect opportunity to repeat an edition of Science Weekly, which took the Radio Academy Sony Gold Award for Best Internet Programme last year. If you've seen Gravity, we hope this enriches your memory of a great movie. And if you've not seen Gravity, this is an excellent primer for that experience.
6 deck by pilot Mark Kelly, flight engineer Lisa Nowak, and mission specialist Mike Fossum. Mission specialist Pierce Sellers headed for 6 months on the International Space Station.
Okay, well, actually, I'll rewind a little bit.
Yes. Yes.
We get a special government breakfast, anything you like. I always had steak and eggs because that's what the Apollo astronauts had. I thought it was required. And then after that, quick clean up. And then you go into the suit up room and get into your orange pressure suits and load up with all your gear for that. And that's kind of fun because you get to sit in the same room where they suited up the Gemini and Apollo guys and all the shuttle guys before you. So the room has some history. Walk out, downstairs, down the elevator, into the van. And then the van with little convoy trundles out, you know, the few miles to the pad. You go past all the... It is kind of a morale boost because you go past all the shuttle engineers and techs who are waving and stuff like that on the way. But there are fewer and fewer people as you get out to the pad. And by the time you get out there, there's just the actual pad rats, you know, the crews that work the vehicle. Up the elevator, up to the 195-foot level, and now it's just you and a few people in white suits who are there to load you into the machine. And you stand around on the platform waiting. And there are two things to do while you're waiting. One is there's a handset, a phone there, so you can phone people if you're one of the last people to be loaded on board. And two, there is a old prison toilet nailed to a piece of plywood up on that level, so you can go and use that. Probably a good idea. Now, while all this is going on, the world is swinging around, you know, the world is rotating, and at some perfect moment, the world swings around so the launch pad is pretty much underneath the flight path of the space station. And that's the moment you want to go. That's the target time and place that you want to hit to the minute to get off the planet. You have the feeling of going faster and faster and faster. You're being mashed back in your seat by the acceleration. And the instruments are unwinding, you know, in front of you, and you can see the speed building up. After about 45 seconds, you get the call that the main engines are going to throttle down so that the shuttle will ease through the transonic region. And you watch the thrust fall down on the instruments. And then you're aware that you're going supersonic about 1 minute after you launched. But you're going supersonic straight up, you know, not along, straight up. And you are zipping along. At some point, you see the sky just go from blue very quickly to black as you punch out of the atmosphere. You keep hammering along like this at first stage for the first 2 minutes. Everything's a lot of vibration, a lot of, you know, rattling and rolling in the cockpit until you get about 2 minutes. Then the solid rocket boosters, the thrust tails off, and there's a huge bang and a flash, and those puppets fall off.
Everything looking good on the Bird. Solid rocket booster separation confirmed. Guidance now converging. Onboard computers commanding the main engine nozzles to swivel, aiming the shuttle for its precise target in space for main engine cutoff.
Hammering log at Mach 3, 25,000 feet per second or so, and you watch the counter come down. There's a little arrow that moves from right to left on the instrument in front of you. The clock's down the last 10 seconds before main engine cutoff, MECO. And at that second, you hear a bang. Engines cut off. And you go from 3G to 0G in a fraction of a second. So from being shoved back in your seat and not really able to move at all, to you floating forward and bouncing around your straps and everything else in the cockpit that's sort of unrestrained starts floating around too. And there you are in 0G, scooting around above the Earth. It happens instantaneously, and you're ready for it, but it's still always a bit of a surprise, and everyone's laughing at that point. It's such fun. Yeah, we have a sort of a plan to get us through the first day, basically get out of your suits, hang all those guys up, get comfortable, then convert the shuttle from being a rocket into being a spacecraft, putting out computers, moving bags around, stuff like that. That takes actually longer than you'd think. It takes about 4 or 5 hours. The next day, you catch up with space station, and the day after that, you dock. And that's exciting. You slowly sneak up on it, and the space station goes from being a very distant star when you can first see it to a brighter and brighter light, and then eventually this gigantic, full of shining silver structure that's hanging there in the black sky above you. You sneak up below it, and then at the appropriate moment, the shuttle does a complete, you know, the pitch around move maneuver, where the shuttle does a loop effectively 600 feet below the station. So the guys on station can photograph the belly of the shuttle to see if there's been any damage and send all that digital data back to the ground. So you do that, and then you come up level with the station and slowly kind of ease yourself in towards it. It's a bit like, you know, a very delicate parking job. So the idea is to basically match up velocities so that you dock at about 1 inch per second when you finally come in.
Morning. Flight day 8, and Tracy and I are going to do a little bit of robotics here to move the pallet.
It's cramped, but very functional. You know, the designers put a lot of thought and effort into trying to make this place as efficient a workplace as possible. The extraordinary thing is, particularly this when you're spacewalking, is that sometimes it looks like you'd expect it to look, which is you're flying over a gigantic blue rotating ball with a black sky, and it's breathtakingly beautiful. But other times, your perception can play some tricks on you. Quite often, you feel that the world is like a big wall on one side of you, and you're flying sort of horizontally around it. So it's this big curving blue wall that goes above your head and below your feet, and you're scooting around the side of it in a long arc. And other times it's like a big ball above you and you're going underneath it. So the orientation changes a little bit. It's so bright. When you look at the world, it's incredibly bright. The blue, the seas, you know, the oceans, they look like blue neon. They're so bright. It hurts your eyes. Clouds are very bright. You can see everything on the continents. You can see the rivers, the mountains, forests, cities, all sorts of things. A tremendous amount of detail. Even big fields. You can see big fields if you look carefully. So, great view, and you get to go around the world every 100 minutes and so see a new piece every time.
Scott Altman, our commander, who flew the space shuttle in formation with the telescope, going how fast?
17,500 miles an hour.
Very fast. Formation. Very, very fast.
Well, so like for Ascent, you're kind of just being so thrown back. We got the capability to take over and hand fly it if we need to. And then on orbit, it flies totally different than anything because you're floating and you're using your control systems in a different way. On entry, coming back to land, when we get back in the atmosphere and the commander actually takes over and hand flies it, it is a big vehicle and you are coming down like a brick, but it actually feels relatively crisp, especially in roll. I was very pleased with how it responded to my inputs and how much easier in a way it was to handle than the simulations we'd done both on the ground and in the air in the shuttle training aircraft. I thought the shuttle itself flew better than all of the sims.
Then on entry day, you get up early, and it's a sprint. You know, you have to pack away everything, secure everything, get in your pressure suits, everyone's sitting in their places. And the whole business really starts at the deorbit burn. So you turn the shuttle so the tail's pointing into the wind, if you like, let rip with the engines for a long burn to kick the shuttle out of orbit, then flip the shuttle over so its nose is now pointing in the wind, it's pointing the right way for hitting the atmosphere. And very quickly after that, you start descending into the upper layers of the atmosphere. You don't see much to start with, but after a while, you get this beautiful cherry red glow all around the shuttle, and you can see it snapping over the tail, it kind of pulses. But over the forward cockpit windows, it's just a beautiful cherry red that you can see through. In daylight, you can see through this red haze and see the world.
As you go a little lower and a little further, you start to notice it changing to a little bit darker, kind of into the yellows. And as I'm sitting up there in my pilot seat on my second entry, I was looking out at that, and I started to see it get a little bit darker. So I floated up in my seat a little bit and looked towards the nose, and I could see it transitioning from yellow to kind of pink. And I floated up a little higher, and it was starting to go red. I was like, ooh, I don't know if I want to look anymore. So I floated back down in my seat because it just looked too hot, too brutal out there.
And then what's even more remarkable is you're scooting along and you're going very, very fast and relatively low down in the atmosphere. So you see cloud tops just whipping by you as the shuttle decelerates over the Pacific Ocean. You know, it does a couple of big S-turns to slow down over the Pacific Ocean.
you know from the moment you do your final deorbit burn, and you're about 12,000 miles away from your landing point at that point. But once you slow down that little bit, one thing you know for certain is that in about an hour, the shuttle is going to hit the surface of the Earth. The challenge to you as a commander and the pilot is to make sure that where you hit the Earth has a runway underneath it.
Atlantis Houston, on energy approaching the hack.
Deploy. Copy them. I'll drag ship deploy and my covers are all open.
Same here.
Okay, 1.1 Mach.
Comes the rock road.
You really don't have any sense of gravity yet as you do your burn. You're just almost imperceptibly slowing down. But as you go through the entry a little bit, you'll go to put a card, hang a card on a Velcro spot or something like that, and you let go of it, and you notice it kind of slowly floats to the ground, to the floor. And you're like, wow, look at that. And you do it again. Hey, gravity, we haven't seen that in 2 weeks. And it's amazing, you know, your perspective has changed.
Coming up on 2,000 feet, pre-flare decks. And a pre-flare arm to gear, please.
Your gear is armed, you got a light. Looking good on your lineup.
Angle of ascent is about 30 degrees. In an airliner, it's about 3 degrees. So in an airliner, you think you're coming down and pointed sort of at the dirt, you know, that's only 3 degrees. 30 degrees, when you look out the window, it always looks like you're coming straight down, like a lawn dart, straight at the world. I mean, the world is swimming up towards you incredibly fast.
50 feet. Looking good. 20, 230, 15.
The nose is pointed at the ground, and you know you don't pull up until 2,000 feet, and then you start slowly pulling the nose up, slowing your descent rate, and giving up airspeed to slow that descent rate, targeting a smooth touchdown about 2,500 feet down the runway.
2,000 feet. Commander Scott Altman beginning to flare out the vehicle, pitch the nose up as he approaches runway 22 from the northeast. 300 feet, landing gear down. Main gear touchdown. Nose gear touchdown. Space Shuttle Atlantis is rolling out on runway 22 at Edwards Air Force Base, completing 197.
Well, it is an incredible vehicle. I worked on the next generation vehicle that we were trying to build for exploration purposes after I got back, before this last mission and after it. And I started looking at all the design compromises that have to be made when you're building a new vehicle. And with that knowledge, I look back at the shuttle, and I'm just amazed and thankful to the people who built it at all the capability they built into that vehicle to be able to do so many different things over the life of the shuttle program in 30 years, from expanding basic science to using it as a construction truck for building the space station. It's been a very versatile vehicle. You know, I'll remember the accidents, but I'll also remember the four times the shuttle took me up and brought me back safely. So they're incredible vehicles. I'm going to miss them.
They're real ships with their individual characters and their own nicks and bumps. You know, you look at the shuttle, it's not like this. When you get inside it and look at the outside, it's not like it's this pristine, shining, gleaming piece of metallic sort of technology. It's not like that at all. It looks like a ship. It's got sort of dents and burns, and inside it's got, you know, multiple crews of whack the paintwork, and you can see scratches and things. So they're ships that have been operated and lived in and done these incredible voyages, all with their individual characters. I'm personally very fond of the shuttle. And when they wind up in museums, I'll go and see them. I'll go and see them, and I'll be happy to see them. Old friend.
That's all for this week on Science Weekly. Alok Jha is off to Antarctica, and if you want to keep tabs on his journey in written and video form, just go to theguardian.com/science. But from me, Kevin Fong, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, we'll be back next Monday. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.